This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. Since 1988, Whitetail Institute has been perfecting annual and perennial seed products specifically for hunters who plant food plots. Their seeds have been engineered to be palatable, high in protein, and extremely attractive to deer. Whether you live in the Deep South or Midwest farm country, they have products that will help you grow your best food plot yet. For more information about their seeds and their blends, visit whitetailinstitute.com. Enter the discount code SE15 for 15% off.
It's not just something you made. It's the privilege that you get to work with your hands. It's building something that serves a purpose. Proof that you have the grit to keep going. At Timberland, we understand you take your craft seriously, and we do too, which is why our products are built to the highest quality. We put in the work so you can perfect yours, with purpose in every detail and crafted with intention. Timberland, built on craft. Visit Timberland.com to shop.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Spring break isn't what it used to be. It's better. This spring, stay 3 nights and get a $50 Best Western gift card. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Visit bestwestern.com for complete terms and conditions.
Welcome back to the Western Rookie Podcast, brought to you by Go Hunt. Today's episode, we've got... I know the Podfather's used quite often, but to me, you're kind of like the Podfather, Dan Johnson, Nine Finger Chronicles, Sportsman's Empire. How are you doing today, Dan?
I'm doing good. How about you?
I'm doing awesome, man. Yeah. It's July 1st as we record this. I think this will come out a little bit later, but for me, July is that like turning of the calendar's month. Like last year's over, and now it's all about like getting ready for this following season, and man, once we hit July, the 4th happens. Everyone's like still focused on the 4th and, you know, summer. But after that, I feel like it's just like bing, bang, boom. We're at hunting season.
Yep. That's a fact, my friend. I'll tell you this right now. I got a text message from the guy that I go mule deer hunting with. And so I drew a mule deer tag again this year, and he drew again this year. And so he's like, "Hey dude, I'm getting set up. You in?" I said, "I'm in." And now we're starting the planning and the preparation. There's this little cabin. There's no running water in it or anything like that. So we got to take like baths and showers in a shower house that's in this campground where we post up at. And so those are getting booked. So now it's slowly getting real again. And after July 4th is over, then it's like, okay, if I don't start now doing certain things, I'm going to be behind when it's time to get in the truck and start going west.
Yeah. Fortunately for me, Abby and I are doing a rifle mule deer hunt this year in Colorado. Yep. So we get the benefit of like another 2 months of prep and planning, but still like for anyone that does a lot of hunting, right? Beyond like the one weekend deer camp,
Yep.
We got you got multiple things, right? You're like, I got to make sure this camera's got batteries and maybe working on this minute. I got to make sure this minocyte's filled up. I got to do this food plot. I got to do, you know, it's just like, oh, we got to set up. We're putting up a new blind. So many things. Oh, we should be shooting our rifles. You know, we should start practicing. And I'm sure it's the same for a lot of folks. It's not just that one hunt,
right?
It's getting ready for that and everything else. If you're like a serious, avid, you know, deer hunter back home, there's a lot of stuff that takes on too.
Yep. That's a fact. And as a father of three, who every kid is in an activity through, whether it's camps or sports, baseball, wrestling, shuttling them back and forth to wherever they need to be this summer, I haven't had one trail camera placed out in the woods yet for whitetail season yet. So here I am again behind. I have to dust my bow off and I have to get shooting again. I got to get some arrows made for this upcoming year, like I do every year. And then slowly start stair-stepping it. But I need that push. I need that kind of oh shit moment to where I'm like, uh-oh, I got to start working here or I'm going to be behind.
Yeah. So you flip your arrows every season?
Depending on, so this year I have to, and the reason I had to is it's not a proud moment, but I usually lose an arrow in my backyard when I'm starting the tuning process. It took me 4 arrows to kill my mule deer this year, because okay, I spined it and then it rolled down a hill. And then I shot it and then it rolled some more. And then I had to put 2 more in it for, you know, just to get it done.
Right. Yeah.
And so, you know, that's not how you want it, but 2 of those arrows broke and then he rolled on the other 2. So I don't know if they're good enough. And so I'm left with like 5. And so I'm just kind of anal about certain things. So if I'm going to make a dozen, I'm going to make a new dozen. And then the other ones go to maybe like a backup set of arrows or target arrows or something like that. I don't know. I'm weird about that kind of stuff.
I think it's interesting because the other day I was looking for a picture for something and I'm scrolling through like Google Drive and I was like, oh, all right, cool. In 2018 for our elk hunt, I built 24 arrows.
Yeah.
And those are the same arrows I've been using for the last 7 years.
Yeah.
And I've been knowing they're getting old, but when you build 24, and I don't shoot a ton of animals with my bow, I lose a couple here and there. I'll break a couple. The most annoying thing is when you shoot like 3D League this year, shot right through some targets and then buried it into plywood behind.
Yep.
And I'm like, get better targets, guys. Like,
for me, it's or you're grouping, right? And I've had to learn this the hard way. So weird thing about me is I don't use field points a lot. I just broadhead everything these days. And I feel like
a really good target sponsor.
Well, no, I just go through targets is what I do. And so I got like Reinhardt. They're a really good their broadhead targets are pretty hefty and they last a long time. But long story short, I throw the broadheads on, and really what it does is it saves me from having to do really any broadhead tuning every single year. I just put my broadheads on and I shoot. And so I've had to learn the hard way where, okay, if I'm going to aim at the same exact spot on my target every year, I'm damaging fletchings. I'm going to blow some knocks out. I've learned and now I'm picking out different spots on the target to aim at every single shot. So I'm not destroying arrows every single day.
That's interesting. I haven't broken an arrow shooting, and maybe that's because I suck in years, but I do shoot micro diameter arrows and I shoot the top hat field points, which are they're a steel, but there's like, it's a super sharp angle. Like some of these field points are like blunt tips almost.
Yep.
These are a super sharp steel angle. And so I think between the two, like you have to really Robin Hood in order to get it perfect. And if it's not, those angles and the micro diameter, like I'll hear it a lot and be like, oh, I probably screwed up an arrow. You get there, it's just fine. I think I have a lot of deflections. And I'm telling myself, no, I don't suck. It's because of the arrow. I don't know if it's true, but
it is what it is. We can hype ourselves up any way that we want, right?
Yeah, some days need to.
Yeah. Yep. I shoot good. I shoot. There's days where I'll rip an arrow down, bullseye, first shot. And I'll go, you know what? Good enough. Like I'm on right now. And then there's days where I will shoot 50. I probably should have been done at 20. And then I go down this rabbit hole of just like, I suck, micro adjust. Meanwhile, it's me and my form why I'm missing. It's not the equipment's fault at all. It's my shitty form. So,
yeah. Yeah, I feel you. My favorite trick is when you forget to dial your sight back to 20.
Oh, yeah.
And you were finished yesterday at like 80, and you just take that first arrow and just right into the swamp, and you're like, I'm not even going to look for that.
Yep. If my neighbor ever does any type of like grass replacement and they have to lay new sod in their backyard, they're going to probably find 25 arrows that I've lost in their backyard.
Yep. You know, I know, I found at a young age, because when I was young, I really did suck. My dad said, I'll buy you a bow when you can shoot, like, I can't remember, it was a grouping with his old bow, but he had like all aluminum arrows and they were all bent. Mm-hmm. And so I was losing arrows all the time. And so what I learned at a young age, because I was always shooting barefoot in the summer, right? I'm like 12, 14, stay home all year. We lived on a lake, so I never wore shoes. And so I would just be walking around looking for my arrow. And more times than not, I would feel stepping on them when I'm barefoot. You can feel the shaft underneath the grass. And now when I lose an arrow and I really can't find it, I take my shoes off and I just zigzag back and forth. Yeah. And eventually I'll step on it and find it.
Yeah, that's bad. Like I said, because for me,
you have broadheads. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm using broadheads, and like, knock on wood, I hope my neighbor doesn't hear this. Like if they go deep into their backyard barefoot, all their kids are older now, but they do have dogs. So I find most of them, but there are a couple out there that are, I don't know where they're at. And luckily, hopefully time has just driven them down into the ground so the dogs don't step on them or anything.
But metal detector for those. That's also expensive on broadhead when you can't find one.
Yeah.
I don't know. What are you shooting? Are you shooting like high quality? I mean, I feel like now the cool thing is to be shooting like $200 3-pack broadheads.
No. Nope. Well, high quality, yes, because most of their heads are made in the United States, but $200 for a 3-pack, no. So for like mule deer and whitetails, I shoot mechanicals, and that's the Wasp jackhammer. I've been shooting that head for probably minus 1 or 2 years since 2006. I've been shooting those heads, same exact head. I don't know what it is, dude. They just destroy whatever they hit. And you know, we talk about putting an arrow in a bad spot. I mean, man, they just crush everything they hit. And then usually if I'm going on an elk hunt, like when I go on an elk hunt, I'll switch to a fixed blade, and then I'll shoot a different head by Wasp. Like it's not a huge head, but it's a Boss 4 blade, and it's 4 blades, but that's typically what I shoot. Or they have, God, I can't remember the other one that they shoot. They have, get it, the Tradition or something like that. It's a big fixed blade. It's like a 2-blade, but then they got the bleeder blades on the opposite sides.
Yeah, I don't know. I've bounced around so many broadheads over the years. I'm like the opposite of you, where I think, so I would have turned 12 in 2006 as well, and was shooting Muzzies, the Muzzy Trocar, then the 125 Muzzy. And then that's what Dad picked for me at that point. And then I was like, when I got my license, you drive into Fleet Farm to buy fishing lures and hunting stuff on your own. Then I started switching to like NAP 3 blades, and then went through a phase of like kill zones. And so I have an old tackle box that I use for my archery stuff, and it's just every broadhead under the sun in that joker. I mean, they're all in there. But this year I have switched to a 200 grain single bevel with bleeders for almost everything.
Yep.
And with my bow and my draw length, so I'm shooting 30.5-inch draw length, and I'm at 70 right now, but I might crank it up to 75 this fall. Mm-hmm. 600 grain arrow, single bevel, two blade fixed 30 and a half. I mean, I'm shooting a rocket, right?
You're
I'm
shooting a rocket
jaw length.
You're shooting a crowbar at a rocket speed is what you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to take a doe and I want to put that thing like front side of the heart and see what happens.
Yeah.
Because I got to believe it's going to bust through a blade on a doe for sure. Like I want to start building confidence to put that pin where I really want my arrow. I think a lot of times when I was shooting an expandable, I even shot some four blade expandables, as crazy as that sounds. I'm always so scared of that front shoulder that I'm starting to aim at like lung. But I think a lot of people view the lung as like a vertical line. Mm-hmm. And so they like, oh, I can go back this far and shoot the lung. Well, the lung's a diagonal line.
Yep.
You know, it goes back a long ways at the top. But if you're aiming at that like heart height and lung, you know, left and right, you're going to hit a liver. And I was doing that over and over again. And because of that fear of that shoulder. And now I want to start getting confidence on like whitetails with my setup. Put the arrow where you want it, through the center of the heart. If there's a little angle, you're just going to obliterate a bone. I hope that's true. I've heard a ton of people that I've talked to with the same or similar setups taking like quartering two shots on bucks and blowing out the front shoulder, cutting the heart in half and burying the arrow in the back in the food plot. And so I just, the first time though, man, it's just nerve wracking.
Yeah. I'll say this, man, the year that I jumped up to a, what I guess you would call industry standard heavy arrow, I was like plus 500. So right now I think I'm right at 550, somewhere between 525 and 550. I can't remember, but I think for a couple of years I was right, like between 500 and 512. It was like 498 total and 512 or something like that. Anyway, I had a doe step out and I had seen a buck in the pasture coming towards me. And I was like, he's not a shooter. And so this doe was standing in front of me and I said, you're it tonight. And she was kind of at a quartering away and I buried it into her opposite side joint on her. And this was with a mechanical. So, you know, with a mechanical, there's quite a bit of energy loss that goes into the arrow when it hits that opposite side. Right. And so I was probably 20 yards and I just smoked her. I mean, that all that force hit that arrow and she left her feet like she was frozen and someone just cow tipped her over. And then she stood up and flopped around. And I'm attributing that kind of power to the heavy arrow at 70 inch draw at 30 inch or 70 inch poundage, 70 pound weight, excuse me, and 30 inch draw. And I smoked her. I just decimated her. And
yeah, I mean, you probably got 80 foot pounds of kinetic energy coming out of your bow. And when you transfer all of that because the arrow stopped, I mean, that is a lot. Typically, bows and arrows don't kill by energy transfer, they kill by hemorrhage, right? So they kill by efficiently slicing arteries open, whereas rifles are the opposite. They kill by like ballistic shock and that energy transfer that's creating all of that micro trauma throughout the body cavity where every capillary is busted.
Yep.
And it's not as much the entry wound, it's the catastrophic damage that ripples through them. So you want a lot of energy transfer in a bullet most of the time. But yeah, so to hear that and to see it like, it's like, yeah, well, that works too. You know, you put more energy into an animal, they're going to feel it.
Or when you shoot them and they just stand there because they don't know what happened. They're like, what?
That's like the craziest thing about elk.
Yeah.
They're like the elk are like the, like Holstein cattle, like a Holstein bull of the whitetail woods or the hunting woods, right? Like you shoot that elk. I've shot an elk with a 300 Win Mag four times and he didn't move. He stayed in his tracks. And I'm like, I'm very much a believer. If you put a bullet in an elk, keep shooting until he tips over.
Yep.
I mean, now this is when you use the 700 yard shot. If you have to, not your first shot, but like, if you've got a wounded elk, keep shooting until he's on the ground.
Yep.
And so I shoot and I'm like, I had to have hit him. Shoot again. I'm like, man, these are feeling good. Nothing's happening. Shoot him again. I'm like, this is nuts. I had to pull out one from my sleeve, put it in there. shoot again. And after the fourth one, I'm like, he hasn't moved at all. By now the herd's gone, separated. And I'm like, I feel like I missed him all four times. And all of a sudden he just went boop, and just poop. And then he started sliding down a hill. And then I'm like, oh, that is a pretty steep hill. I didn't think it was that steep. All four of them. I mean, he just ate them. Just every single one. 200 grain, 300 Win Mag bullets. It's crazy what those, like nothing else does that.
Yeah. Man, I'll tell you, I, you know, you got that rifle story. I got stories where I actually did a podcast with a guy. Man, this was several years ago, but he drilled this buck. He shot it high lung.
Okay.
And he's like, okay, buck's dead. I just have to go recover him. Never found him. The next year, his wife shot the same deer during the gun season, and they're taking out his body parts, and two lobes of his high lung were dead, and the buck survived.
That's crazy.
And how they can survive after getting crushed by an arrow. Like you put an arrow through my lung, I'm dead. Like I'm not even going to try to live. I'm just, give up. I'm done. You know, it's crazy what they can go through.
We are so weak. Yeah. Compared. I mean, we've had people on the podcast before. Like one of them was a guide and they shot a bull. He pulled a broadhead out of the lung, still in there.
Oh yeah.
And that was like all mass cover, like years old. But yeah, it's crazy how tough they are compared to us.
Yep. Absolutely. Yeah.
So mule deer this fall.
Yep.
Same place. Are you going back to the same place year after year? It sounds like you've got a couple of things that you've figured out about the place you go that allows you to hunt it better.
So over the course of the years, I have gathered Onyx points from the border of Iowa and South Dakota, or Minnesota and South Dakota, to the Wyoming border. I mean, and everywhere in between, all along that interstate, north and south. And so there are pockets where I'm okay, like personally, with if an area is dead and I know it should be good, I show up, I'll hunt a day or two. I don't have a problem getting in my truck and driving an additional 2 or 3 hours and setting up camp somewhere else because I'm in my truck usually.
Yeah.
And so last year, we got into this spot, the deer were there, so we stayed the whole time. But in previous years, what I've done is I'll go as far west in the state as I possibly can, go to the spots where I located deer. And if they're not there, you know, I'll give it a more like a couple days maybe. And then I work my way back. And so I go far away and then I'll slowly start working my way back into, I don't know, where mule deer start in South Dakota. And then usually by that day, if I'm not on anything or I don't have any opportunities, then I'm that much closer to home. So I just tend to, you know, I there's times where I know they're there. I see them, I stay. And then there's other times where I think, man, I'm trying to remember what year it was. It was so dry and the cattle had just crushed everything. And the deer were not in the spots that I wanted, like that I'd seen them previous years. They were lower. Most of them were on private. And then I just started working my way back until I found a couple spots that had, water still in them, and that's where they were all at. And then time ran out and I had to go home.
Dang. Yep. It's always time. I mean, that's one of the things that's unique about traveling. The traveling hunter is there's this unique time aspect where, you know, we've heard so many people on the podcast that I've been like, man, you shoot a ton of great bucks. I mean, there's a wall behind them. You know, what's your secret? Like, how are you doing this? He's like, well, you know, this one we watched for 5 years until he was ready.
Right.
And my son ranches for the landowner. So we got permission there. And you know, we glassed him for about 16 weeks. Mm-hmm. And then he came down and we got him. And it's like, great story. Happy
Not relatable.
You. Nothing applies to me. I got 5 days. I've never been here before. I mean, quite frankly, out west, I don't have time to knock on doors. Knocking on doors takes a whole day.
Yep.
By the time you go to places, find out where the guy lives, drive over there, knock on the door. He wasn't home. Find his number. I mean, it could easily take 3 hours per property. You're going to get turned down 80, 90% of the time. And I got 5 days. I got to get back to work. Yep. So I just write off private land. completely. Yep. Now, if I'm going to go back every single year and I know that, maybe it makes sense to start putting some irons in the fire. But we don't go back to the same places very often.
Right.
If we do, it's elk, which archery hunting elk isn't really a private land issue. Yep. And so I write that off. And, you know, it's like, okay, well, I got 5 days. I have no idea what the animals are out here. I don't know where they are. I got to find them, get on them, get back to work.
Yep. So I'll tell you one thing that I've done is anybody that I see on the road or working cattle or fixing fence or something, I talk to them. I'm that guy who I'll stop and I'll go like, hey, so what's the story this year? Dry this year. And then usually what you'll hear from those guys, it's dry every year out here, whatever, you know? And so what you do is you just bullshit with them for a little bit. And long story short, man, I know I'm not going to be able to hunt on their land, but I throw them a text 2 or 3 times a year. I send them, you know, hey, dude, I shot this buck in Iowa, or I shot this buck in Kansas, or I got my first mule deer this year, whatever the case is. And I share that information with them. It strikes up some commentary. And then long story short, I go, hey, what are the mule deer doing right now? What are the elk doing right now? They're high still? Okay, cool. Maybe I wait. You know, and so I'm flexible where I can adjust my, you know, I can adjust my time going out there. I don't have to take PTO or whatever, but I still have only 8 days to get the job done. And 2 of those days are driving. So it's all for me about trying to create relationships, even if it's just some form of communication out there. And like, hey, dude, I saw him. You know, hey, I was driving to work cattle and I saw a good buck there. I'll show you where he's at on BLM ground or grassland or whatever. I'm like, okay, cool, man. So you get a little bit of that going, and yes, it's not hunting private, but it's eyes out there that you don't have.
Yeah.
You're building out a network.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which makes a ton of sense because you go back to that state every year. It's like that's your rutcation. It's just in September. And that makes a ton of sense. Like my favorite state for elk hunting, I haven't been back to for 5 years. Yep. So it's just hard to like invest in building a network in the backcountry. Unfortunately, as much as it sucks, most of the landowners are billionaires or millionaires from out of state anyway.
100%.
And so it's like you're going to maintain a relationship for once every 5 years. So that part's tough. If I was doing your trip 100%, and a lot of the waterfall guys that I used to hunt with are huge on building out networks because they know they're going to go to each of these states probably multiple times a fall, and they want really good networks with their farmers and landowners.
Yep, 100%. Now, like you said, now I'm sitting on, this year is going to be my 10th preference point for elk, I believe.
In what state?
For Wyoming.
Ooh.
Yep. So now I'm starting to get to
a
good position there. I have the same amount for antelope, which you probably don't need 10 to go find some good antelope hunting. But
so that's the fastest growing point creep in America right now.
Yeah.
It's an antelope.
And it's probably because it doesn't take as long to get an antelope tag as it would in some of these units for elk.
Unfortunately, like 10 points for elk is a lot, and you're starting to unlock some awesome units at 10 points for sure. Mm-hmm. Antelope, it used to be like 3-4. And then like a couple things happened. So like right off the bat, antelope are down significantly on like a multi-decade trend line, and people are doing it more. And so now when you could get into like potential for Booner class antelope at 4 points, it's taken 8, 9, 10 points now to really have a hunt where you're going to look at antelope for 5 days straight. And on the 6th day, go shoot the biggest one you saw.
Yep.
That's the kind of hunt that Boone and Crockett style hunt.
Yep.
Yeah. You need 10 points, which sucks, but those are in Wyoming, especially to have 10 points for both of those. I mean, like I wouldn't sit on those too long, buddy. I mean, there's a huge burden. Like we talk about all the time on this show, but like you wait. All right, I'm going to cash in. And then that year the unit burns to the ground.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. And who knows, right? Who knows what the hell's going on. But the good thing about having that type of communication. For example, there's a lot of great insight that goes through Go Hunt and, you know, some of the other forums that are out there of dudes like, hey, it's dry, beware, or other things that happen. And you get to know, it's information really is what it is. It's a gathering of information. But I also have, I believe, 8 deer points for Wyoming too. So when I kind of wish though that I started collecting other like bighorn sheep 10 years ago, because in another 10 years or 25, you know, 15 years, when I'm only going to be able to use a rifle, then I feel like I missed out on an opportunity there for like a once in a lifetime type hunt, as opposed to I probably couldn't afford it, even though I did have it, but you get what I'm saying.
Yeah. The sheep thing in the lower 48. I mean, there's some over the counter units, and if you want to really get depressed, you can look at the success rates for the over the counter bighorn units in Montana. But lower 48 sheep is pretty much mathematically impossible to draw if you start today. Anyway, to draw, there's over the counter options, but like I said, it's been like 0% success rate for the last 10 years. So it's like, in 2005, someone saw one. So what I recommend people is like, if you know you want to be a sheep hunter someday and do a sheep hunt, forget about buying $200 preference points and applying in all these states every year. Just start putting that money in a good growth stock mutual fund, and in 40 years, cash it out and go to British Columbia.
There you go.
There's
your secret. There's your secret.
That's what it takes. I mean, unfortunately, like the math, we talk about every single state, and I think every single state is below 1% odds with max points for non-residents.
Yeah.
So that's
ridiculous.
It's going to take someone with already having max points. They've already got 32 points. It's still going to take them more than 100 years to draw on average.
Yeah.
So it's just like,
So for me, I look at, so obviously I've done the time with Wyoming to collect preference points.
Yep.
The other states that really interest me, and for no other reason, it would just be something extra. And that's like New Mexico with their lottery.
Oh yeah.
Where it's just like, I don't know shit about New Mexico. I don't have any contacts in New Mexico, but you know what? I'll throw my name in the hat on a lottery, and more than likely, I know I'm probably not going to get it. But in the rare case that I do, then I can go, like, I can have an opportunity to maybe X out and go backtrack on some of my other tags that I have and go, okay, well, I'm going to send this back. I'm going to keep the preference point, and then I'm going to go do New Mexico, knowing that I will have to, I'll be behind in scouting. I'll be behind in any type of knowledge about areas, and just kind of shoot from the hip and see what happens. But it would be something extra on top of what I'm already
thinking, like elk, mule deer, antelope.
Well, when I think of New Mexico, I'm thinking about elk.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's why wouldn't you with New Mexico?
Yeah.
So the awesome thing about New Mexico, for the folks that don't know what Dan's talking to, is there's no point system. It's just a straight odds every year. I think if you draw certain tags, you have to take a breather. Like, they don't let you reapply for like 5 years, but you just basically go down the list and you decide like, where's your tipping point, right? Cause you can't ever bank on drawing. So you can't say like, oh, I want to, you know, this is the hunt this year. Cause you never know. You have to be kind of flexible, but you could swing for the fences and hunt the Gila, and you might take 100 years to draw. Right? It might be 2% odds. Or you could say, you know what? I just want to go to New Mexico and I want to find a unit that I'm going to apply to every year. And I might draw it 4 times in my lifetime. And that 4th time is going to be magical. Like, I'm going to have all the spots, and you might, you know, you can even go further. There's some units you can draw with 30% odds. It's might not be the magical New Mexico you're dreaming of, but yeah, you just kind of find that sweet spot. Like, where am I looking at? Like, do I want a 5%, a 10%, a 20%?
I did a podcast with a guy several years ago, and I think it was before they had the dead period. Some of them call it the dead period, where after you draw, you cannot reapply for I think it's 4 years now or something like that. He drew the Gila 2 years in a row.
Ooh.
And this is a 20-year-old who did it. And he's like, You want to know how many people were pissed off at me?
Yeah.
That there was like these 50-year-olds that have been trying for years and years to go, and this guy goes 2 years in a row.
And the reason why the law showed up.
Probably.
Yeah.
And so, he killed elk both years when he was out there. So, I mean, shit, I can't remember when I did that podcast, maybe 4, 5, 7 even years ago. It's been a long time.
So if you put in for the Gila and you draw it, are you going to like go down a list of people in your phone of like, who am I going to call to come out and call for me?
Yes. I got a buddy in Colorado. He lives close. And depending on when he has his kid, like if he's got his kid or if his ex-wife has his kid that week, then I would be like, dude, come down. I'm paying for everything. You just call for me. Or I'm going to just call some of the bigger guys, like the company owners that I've met over the course of the year who have hunted that in the past, whether it's through an outfitter or a guide service or whatever. And I'm just going to be like, tell me what you know. And because it takes so long to get into these places, I feel like some of these people would be willing to give up a little bit more information than if it was like a really, truly like honey hole where like if you're only hunting a place one every 12 years, you might as well give up a little bit of information because the elk herd that you would potentially be hunting next time is not the elk herd that's there right now. So,
yeah, or like if I tell this guy my secret, chances are he's never going to get to go back to it anyway.
Exactly.
Yeah. I do the same thing with the North Dakota because I did a couple write-ups and articles. And so there's a bunch of stories posted and it's a once in a lifetime tag. Yep. And I'm not even a resident anymore. So, I'm really far removed. So when people draw that tag, the first thing they do is they search, North Dakota elk E3 and they find my articles all over the web. And so every April when North Dakota draws their elk tags, I get like 4 to 5 DMs across random forum sites that I'm not even on anymore asking about info. And I always vet what I give people based on how much legwork they've done to this point on their own. Right. Yeah. Like if it's someone that like has done zero, they just like, hey, can you send me the pin where you killed your bull? I don't give them shit.
Yeah.
If it's someone that's like, it's October, and they reach out to me and they've been like, hey, I found your article. Like, I drew this tag. I've been busting ass. Yeah, I went here. I went there. I've been doing all these things. I can't find elk. Like, I don't know. I got a baby coming in 3 weeks. I got to get, it's like I will help that person infinitely more.
Yep.
Because they've been putting in work.
Yep. 100%.
Like, I will send them my pin on that one.
Yeah. I get that all the time because I live in Iowa, right? Yeah. So guys, when they draw the Iowa tag, they're like, dude, any insight would be awesome. And if it's just a blanket statement, I'll be like, hey man, go check public is all I can give you. Or go check public or get a lease.
Get and private land access is key.
Yep. Exactly. Exact. Some generic statement. But if a guy goes, hey dude, I've narrowed it down to this county or I've narrowed it down to this specific, thing, what do you think?
Yeah.
And then I'll give up any type of knowledge I have throughout, my 44 years of being an Iowa resident. So I'll help people out if they're willing, if they're not just looking for a handout, basically.
Yeah. If there was a week where there's like podcasting is shut down, your wife and kids get invited to a wife and kids only girls trip. And you're just like, it's in the fall. What would be your like over the counter hunt that you would go on? You're tagged out in Iowa, so you can't just be like, well, I would just hunt the Booners I've been tracking all year here full time. Like, because you can't just be like, oh, I'll go to New Mexico elk hunting next week.
Right.
You can't do that. But there's so many opportunities, I think, across the country that people just really don't think about where you could, especially with a bow, like you can buy an over the counter tag and probably get into better deer hunting than you live by.
Right. Two things I'll say is my answer used to be Nebraska.
Yeah.
But now Nebraska is not over the counter anymore ish.
Yeah.
Right.
Probably not in October. I mean,
right. Exactly.
Yeah.
I would instantly start looking at leftover cow tags in certain states and start there knowing, and it would probably be like Wyoming or Colorado, or if there are any cow tags in New Mexico or states that I really want to hunt, and go there and just hunt the post rut, or just a mission to scout.
Yeah.
Right? So I'm gaining intel. So when I do draw these things, that's what I'm going for.
Yeah. Plus it's like, imagine just adding a random cow elk to the freezer.
Exactly.
Like 250 pounds lets you do like, to me, like when you get that much meat, then it frees up to do like fun things. Like we eat so much ground red meat that every, like the first five whitetails we put in the freezer get completely ground. And it's like most years we don't put more than five in.
Yeah.
So we don't get to do anything fun like snack sticks or jerky or, you know, any of the other stuff. Cause it's like, we're just maybe too like functional with how we use them. I mean, it's, my cousin's like, dude, I just buy a beef and then I turn all of my whitetails into jerky because I like whitetail jerky so much. I'm like, well, that's another way to do it. But
yeah.
Man, our family goes through ground venison like that.
Yeah.
Two deer is not enough for our family anymore. One thing that I have noticed where I'm going to have to kill a doe this year just to have it turned into breakfast sausage. Our meat locker, the local meat locker that I take all my deer to, they have this breakfast sausage recipe that they do. Yeah. Oh my God. It's ridiculous. The kids want it every morning. They want it every morning. Hey, we want sausage and eggs. We want sausage and eggs. And so I'm like, all right, I'll do it. And now we're out. And so now I have a handful of months where I'm going to smoke a doe like October 1st here in Iowa. And she's going to be made into breakfast sausages. And that's it.
Yeah, I hear you. I mean, we don't even have kids and we eat 7 pounds of red meat a week. Yeah. So a doe lasts us maybe 5 weeks for the world's biggest doe if I grind up the backstraps, which I'm not going to that level, but you know what I mean? So it's like, okay, basically a deer a month. That's a lot of deer.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. If you're eating that many, just imagine how many, you know, like what you've heard those statistics on mountain lions and how many deer they actually kill in a year. It's ridiculous.
Well, it's partly because they're so efficient at killing and they're solitary animals that when a bear or a wolf pack comes in and steals their kill, they don't even put up a fight because they know they can just go kill another one that day. And so they're killing, I think it was like 150 on average, especially if it's like a female with kits.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Like, talk about, you know, I wonder why we don't have strong antelope numbers anymore. It's like, well, probably because a mountain lion out in the prairie just obliterates them.
Well, also, that makes me embarrassed where a mountain lion can kill 100 deer in a year and
you struggle to kill four.
I can't even get into bow range, you know, bow range of one without it busting me. So it's
that
like,
should be that should be your tip for the people that are like, hey, where's your pins? Be like, well, it's significantly, surveys show it significantly helps if you can get within 30 yards of a big buck.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Just again, just an off statement. Like, hey, what?
Yeah. Well, if you can get within 20, your chances go up a lot.
Right, exactly. Or just give them pins where it's like, hey, it's right off a major intersect, major interstate.
The cedar tree on this clover leaf of the interstate.
Yeah. Saw a dead one here.
Giant right here one day.
Exactly. Walmart parking lot.
And they'd get so excited seeing, because you can't, the Onyx doesn't give you the preview of where the pin is. It's like the Onyx poster board. And so you'd be like, if you sent a text, be like, I saw a booner here one day last summer or this summer, they would be so excited. And they open it up and it's the side of the interstate.
Right. Well, I had a buddy who he moved, or a guy, I shouldn't say my buddy, a guy I know through podcasting. He moved to Eastern Colorado in the Denver area. And so he goes out and he kills a big bull every year in Colorado.
Yeah.
And people ask him, where are you hunting? And he sends them a pin in Estes Park, you know, like, like on the neighborhood course. Elk just bugling. Yeah, exactly. And so they're like, so then they get the hint, don't ask me anymore for that type of information.
Yeah. It's like fishing spots that used to be. Yeah. It's tough. I mean, I want to help people hunt too, but like some of these spots that you put in a lot of work to find, like I've got spots that North Dakota, like my answer would be a North Dakota whitetail hunt. Cause it's one of those places where I know it would be an epic hunt from all the legwork that I've put into this spot. But it's like 8 hours now. And so it's just one of those things that doesn't happen.
Right.
You know, if I've got private here in Minnesota, why, and I still have a tag, why would I leave to go hunt public as good as it is? Yeah. I mean, it's just like, I got to set up my stands. Like, I got stands already set on all of our farms here in Minnesota. So it's just one of those hunts that never happens. But you say, hey, you're tagged out. You know, Abby's on a conference. She's gone all week. You know, work shut down. You got nothing else to do. There's no ice to go ice fishing. I think I'd be like North Dakota whitetail. Like,
yeah,
buy the over-the-counter tag, hit the road with my bow, see what happens.
I'll add one. I'll add maybe two. Oklahoma whitetail, still over-the-counter. North Dakota would be an option. Wisconsin would be an option just because Wisconsin's close. Illinois, over-the-counter, close. You know,
yeah.
Southeast Minnesota, close. Northern Missouri, close. Like, I have that Eastern Iowa and everything that it touches radius where I'm at, where I can be in another, all of those states, Minnesota, yeah, Wisconsin, Illinois, and Missouri in under 3 hours.
Yeah. You so, definitely live in the Booner Belt.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, I'd have to go hunt public out there, but still, I mean, if there's literally nothing going on in my life, which, dude, that sounds really good right about now, I feel, but I also feel like if I'm going to do that, I hunt whitetails enough. Well, I want to go big. I want to go do something, you know, grab a rifle and go see if there's any leftover tags for mule deer or elk in someplace.
The moose one is one where I feel like I need to get into that and do the, figure it out. Like, the first year is going to be all logistics, just like learning how to get to Alaska, get a bush pilot, get to the spot, you know, and that's basically the only thing you're going to get out of that.
Yeah.
But then you're like, okay, well, now that's easy. I figured that out. So now I can do it again and try to get on moose. I mean, but I feel like most of Alaska, you can do DIY moose hunting, a large majority of it. Some places you need an outfitter, but for a large majority of it, you can buy an over-the-counter moose tag and go. And people just don't know it, and they don't do it because it's difficult to get to. It's difficult to fly with a firearm. It's difficult to find a bush plane.
Yep.
But if you get in that habit of going just like every 4 years, imagine the experiences you could have in a 40-year hunting career.
Yeah. Yeah. If you had that money, right? If you
had
that.
It's not even that expensive. Compared to all options, I think you could do a DIY moose hunt for like $3,000 to $4,000 from what I've looked into.
Hey.
Here's which is a lot of money. Okay. For a lot of money.
Here's what I'm going to say. I love you, dude, but that's the answer for a guy with no kids.
Well, true.
You add three kids and then you add my wife. If I spent $3,000 to go on a hunt right now, even if it was something like, if it was like on a whim, she would be so mad. But if it'd be a different story if I said, in 5 years, I'm going on a moose hunt. And then I saved up.
That's the way you do it. Exactly. Like, hey, in 5 years, I want to go on a moose hunt. I'm going to put $75 a month away. I'm going to quit buying bullshit at the gas station.
Cheetos.
On the way to work. And I mean, people spend way more than $75 a month on snacks.
Yep.
No matter who you are. I do it too.
Yep.
But that's how you do it. You put it into a fund, you put it into a CD, do what something, I mean, if you can get 5-10% on that, you know, then it's like, yeah, it's a lot of money, but it's not like, boom, October, take $5,000 out of the checking account. Now the kids don't have shoes.
Hey, although I probably would just be like, cut the fronts open and let your toes go out.
Yeah, just turn them into sandals for a year.
There you go. It's summertime. Yeah. It's summertime.
Yeah, that's how you do it. And then every 4 years, it's like not that big of a deal. And then if you can build that tendency, it's like, that's just part of life. So every month, $75, and I go moose hunting. It used to be every 3 years. Now with, you know, inflation, now it's every 4 years. You're still going moose hunting every 4 years.
Yeah, that's pretty sweet.
Yeah. Instead of paying $40,000 for Jim Shockey to take you around.
Yeah, that's a fact. And although that sounds awesome, it would be sweet. Like, I don't know about you, but I never got into like the television shows or the content creators that were doing what I was doing, like the private land Iowa guys who were killing big whitetails with food plots. And like, yes, that's kind of interesting and it's horn porn. But when I was a kid, man, all I cared about was watching Jim Shockey and watching, God, I forget his name. He's a bow hunter who travels all over the world and he's killed,
Tread Barda?
Could have. It wasn't him.
Oh.
It was an, God, I can't remember his name.
Yeah.
Anyway, he was doing that, and the specific hunt that I want, there's two. One is caribou, and though I don't, who knows if they're going to be able to be hunted here pretty soon, or the float trip Yukon River moose hunts, where they fly you in, drop you off, and then it's 10 days to get back to where you were at, and you stop along the way, and you're all that stuff, dude. That those were dream hunts to me growing up.
Those would be awesome. I remember Jim Shockey. Funny enough, I always also loved watching the bucks at Tecumseh because they were huge.
Oh, yeah.
But then you grow up and you realize like it's all fake and it's high fence and corn feeders. I'm like, all right, never mind. And, I would rather watch the dude sweat his ass off in Southeast Iowa fighting mosquitoes to grow 200-inch bucks than watch people in Texas feed their 200-inch pets.
Yeah. And meanwhile, they look gigantic, but their body size is only like 120-pound mature buck.
Imagine how screwed you'd be hunting where you hunt or where I hunt, where we have like grain fed big Midwestern bodied deer. You'd be like, dude, this is a booner, and you shoot it and it's a 120 and you're like, what the fuck?
2017, I think it was.
Yeah.
That happened to me in 2017 or 18. Dude, I was in this thicket and I got up in the tree, sign everywhere. Doe group comes by and I'm like, it is happening tonight. All these little bucks were coming up from behind me. And then I see this head pop up and I'm like, oh, giant coming in, posturing up, flexing. Yeah. He was all big. He sent checking the does. None of them were in heat. So he comes by and I'm like, full draw. And I couldn't get I couldn't really see his body. I could just see his rack and the proportions to his body.
Yeah.
Draw back, anchor up. I had a split decision because there was only a small gap and I'm like, screw it, take it. Boom. Hit him. I watch him hop over 40 yards. He falls over dead. I'm like, I just shot my biggest buck I've ever shot. Giant whitetail. And I'm getting all hyped up, climb down, walk over to him. Every single step I took, the body got smaller and smaller and smaller. Well, what I did was I shot 140 low 140s class 2 year old and he was bristled up because there was another doe there. And so at an instant he looked really, 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 really big. But then, the whole encounter was like maybe 2 minutes. And so I drew back, shot him. I walk over to him. I'm like, I can literally put this buck in my backpack is how small his body was. But he was a genetic freak. And
140 is still a great buck, but not the 180 you thought you arrowed.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So if he was 250 pounds with different headgear, I would have thought, God, that's a big buck. But his body was so tiny. I was
Look like a booner. It had 9 inches of combined mass.
Exactly.
Yeah, that would be a bummer. I'd like to have that problem, though, someday. I think it'd be fun to hunt Texas.
Yeah. I've hunted Texas for exotics. I mean, that is what it is, over a feeder.
Cheaper than that. Well, maybe not cheaper than Africa, to be honest, but.
Yeah. That's the whole thing right now. There's so many animals in North America I haven't killed yet that I'm not even interested in going to Africa at this point in my life.
I would trade elk over everything in Nebraska in Africa anyway.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to go shoot a lion. Like, lions alone.
Yeah. They're cool.
Yeah. They're cool.
I don't know. I don't want
to go shoot deer in Africa. I think I'd have more fun shooting the deer species in Africa than like anything else, like a kudu or whatever the twisted unicorn antler things are.
Yep.
But you can shoot those in Texas too. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah. Just not some of these animals. When I went to Texas, they had a menu. It was like a restaurant menu
and stapled to the wall of the blind right next to the window. Well,
kind of, but it was at where we would eat breakfast and it was like, here, take a look at what we're offering. And so I was there on a media hunt. Yeah. And so I got to kill, it was like one or two animals
off the list
for free. Right. Yeah. I was there through Faradine and then at lunch, they had the menus on the table or the breakfast. They had the menus on. So just in case you shot something different, you know what you owed.
Yeah.
And dude, it's like, $1,000 or like $2,000 for this, $11,000 for this. There was a couple that were like 30 grand, the Pierce Nellis deer or something like that is what they're Pierce.
And you're like, I thought it was a doe.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so you're like, holy shit. No. Anyway, is what it is. I'd rather hike up into the mountains and physically exhaust myself trying to get an elk.
Instead. They offered like a $50 credit for every wild hog that you shot.
That'd be sweet.
That. I'd sign that up. I don't know how many it takes. You'd have to do the math before you could shoot that, you know, unicorn deer that you talked about, but I'd try.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would also be okay with using a crossbow at that point.
Yeah.
So
I would use a crossbow on turkeys. That's where I draw the line.
So anything above a turkey,
No, only turkeys.
Only turkey. Okay. Only turkeys.
Yeah, I just don't care about turkey hunting that enough to, and it's very hard to like spot and stock run and gun turkey hunt with a bow.
Right.
Yeah. And I don't want to sit in a blind all day. Like that just sounds boring. It's like, it's April or May. I got shit to do. Like I'm exactly. Food plotting. Like I want to go reap this turkey quick with the crossbow and then get back to work.
Yep. That's a fact, my friend. I took my kids out this year for turkey hunting. And then outside of that, I didn't even go this year. I just went, with my boys and my daughter. And then I was like, okay, well, if every day that I'm out here means I got more work to do and I'm not prepared for it. So I'm going to get behind. So now it's turkeys. They're kind of a side project or a side note, yeah. I guess you'd say for me.
My goal is to shoot one with my bow off the deck of my house because they come through the backyard about 3 days every season. We'll have three encounters. And so, and I work from home. So,
yeah. Hey, that's one hell of a goal.
That's the goal. Yeah.
Well, I tell you what, we got to shut her down here. Okay. And I think as far as the next episode that we're going to talk about, we're going to get a little in depth about this transition that's going to be happening with what you're going to be doing and what I'm going to be doing for this feed and the new project that you're taking on, which sounds extremely interesting for all the listeners and whatnot. So stand by for next week's episode. Whenever this launches, it's good. The following episode will be us two again, and we're going to get into the details of a little bit of a transition that's going to be happening here and new projects and new thoughts and ideas and all this. It's a rebirth of sorts.
Yeah. I'm excited. Yeah. There's a lot of exciting stuff happening that you're going to want to be a part of, folks. It's you and I have been talking ideas for months. And so to be, you know, we're kind of getting to that point where we're kind of ready to share some of it. And so I'm super excited. I think you're excited and hopefully the folks are excited to hear, but yeah, so stay tuned. Lots of exciting stuff coming to the Western Rookie podcast.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network. And this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.